I'm Dr. Nathaniel Chin, and you're listening to Dementia Matters, a podcast about Alzheimer's disease. Dementia Matters is a production of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Our goal is to educate listeners on the latest news in Alzheimer's disease research and caregiver strategies. Thanks for joining us. Today's guest on Dementia Matters is Dr. Shyla Mergane, a distinguished psychologist at UW Health and the University of Wisconsin Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation. Dr. Mergane is a frequent contributor and speaker on developing mind-body skills for improved health. Dr. Mergane, welcome to Dementia Matters.
Thanks for having me as a guest. I'm thrilled to be here.
You've built a career around teaching people how to live their best lives. You give people strategies to improve happiness, become more optimistic and confident, and increase their sense of purpose and well-being. These are feelings not everyone thinks of as learned skills. Can you explain your practice and how you help people develop mind and body health?
As a clinical psychologist who specializes in health psychology, I'm really passionate about empowering people to utilize mind-body skills to help them cultivate wellness, but also to prevent chronic diseases. And for those patients who are struggling with either a mental health or a physical health issue, there's so much that they can use from a mind-body perspective to manage their condition day in and day out. Often when we think about healthcare, we think about going to a physician or a physical therapist or getting a procedure done or getting a surgery or intervention. And part of my work is really to give people skills or tools that they can use day in and day out to self-manage not only that physical condition, but really to help promote their overall well-being.
In addition, so what I like about what you said is in addition to preventing disease, you also focus on well-being. How would you define well-being for our audience?
Well-being is, I think, a holistic approach to overall health. It involves things like our physical well-being, our emotional well-being, our mental well-being, even our financial well-being. And we can look at not only how the body is doing, how our emotional fluency and how many positive emotions we're experiencing, our cognitive functioning, but we can expand out to look at how are the quality of our relationships, how is the environment that we're living in, our home life, our community, is that a place where that really allows us to flourish? And then to look at the day-to-day choices we make can either really increase the amount of well-being we have or decrease it. And we can look at, you know, how resilient are we? Can we quickly bounce back from those setbacks in life? Are we able to have the kind of energy that we want to accomplish the things? Do we have a sense of meaning and purpose? Are we really living our values in the work we're doing or the relationships that we're cultivating? And how much joy are we having? You know, many people, I think, in today's society can feel bogged down, whether it's the stress of managing a condition like dementia in a family member, or just worried about the next paycheck and getting food on the table. And sometimes we forget that part of well-being is, you know, are we stopping to smell the roses and really, really, really enjoying the time that we have here?
And once you recognize all those different components, you realize how much they interact with each other.
They do. And I think it's we're seeing more and more of this in healthcare, that 30, 40 years ago, we would treat the ailment, the body part, diagnose it, do the intervention, and you'd be done. And that's part of the equation. But we are really looking more holistically at not only all aspects of health, but also the question that I often like to ask is, what do you want your health for? You know, what getting healthier, even if it's two steps forward in the direction of your health, what would that allow you to do? How would that allow you to show up in the world? And what kind of contribution can you make when you are living that healthier life?
Well, how can simply having a positive attitude make someone healthier or contribute to someone's health?
That's such a great question. And again, when we go back to that well-being model, having that positive outlook is a really important component to flourishing in life. And there's just such a large growing body of research that shows that having and cultivating that positive outlook can really benefit your health. And positive outlook is a little different than just being positive all the time and having that rose-colored glasses in life. with that positive outlook, we do feel distressing emotions like sadness and anger. But the key really is balance, that you have more positive emotions than often negative emotions. And we find that people who have that positive outlook often have more resilience. They can bounce back quicker. That lingering, difficult, distressing emotions, those, when they come up, you're able to process them and move through them so they're not getting stuck. And there is research that shows that when you have that more positive outlook, some of those more positive emotions, and you track patients over time, you see them doing better. There was a study that showed more optimistic patients 12 months later were more likely to have quit smoking, to be getting more regular physical activity, to be eating more fruits and vegetables, less sweets, and having and maintaining a healthy healthy BMI. So I like to think of part of the reason for that is when we have that optimistic outlook, we're more optimistic about our health. We might even feel better about our body, have that better body image. So we're more likely to invest in those daily actions that keep us healthy and allow us to have the greatest level of well-being.
Now, loneliness is a known risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. Can you offer a few strategies people can use to increase being social and with other people?
Absolutely. And I often like to talk about it as an epidemic of loneliness that we're experiencing in our culture, that despite the fact that we can connect in an instant with social media or a text or FaceTime, that we're increasingly getting disconnected from that face-to-face kind of connection. People are often so busy that it's quicker to send that text versus pick up the call or meet for coffee. And around the age of 50, the feelings of loneliness increase. I think that's in part for a variety of reasons. Kids may have gone to college. You might be an empty nester. You may be nearing retirement. Friends might have moved away or gotten involved in other activities, so they're less available. And again, loneliness is, there are health concerns. There's research that shows loneliness has the same effect on our health as smoking does, that across genders, when people are feeling lonely or socially isolated, it contributes to increased inflammation in the body, and it can be a contributing factor to mortality. So building and maintaining and strengthening that social support network is so important, especially across the lifespan. I think of when you're young, it's really easy to make friends. You go to school and you're surrounded by young people that want to get to know you. Your first job, you go to college, you know, they're instant friends. But as we age, our social network can start to shrink. So just some tips to how to build that social network. I encourage people to keep making friends. Join a club, try a hobby, take a class, go to places where you're surrounded with people, like in the coffee shop or the library. And I encourage people to say hello. You know, say hello to the clerk. Wish somebody you're holding the door open for a good day. Spend the time and talk with your neighbor. You can volunteer, too. That's a great way to connect with like-minded people. And then it's always important to invest in those relationships you already have. Maybe you've gotten disconnected from a childhood friend or somebody that you're close with in your 30s. Reach out to them. Send them a letter. Invite them out for coffee or do an activity together, because it's really those moments face-to-face building memories that are the glue that keeps those relationships together. So it's something to schedule and make time for. So it could even be, I'm going to reach out to one person a week that I haven't spent much time with and let them know how meaningful they are to you. I recently received a text from a friend I hadn't seen in a while who just said, hey, I read a book and I realized life is short, and I'm just reaching out to all the people who mean a lot to me to say, you matter, and that person wanted me to know that in that moment.
Now, that's a sweet message. But what you're saying really is you have to make it intentional and take time, take the initiative to connect with people.
Very much so. That strong network of social support is really, really helpful. And some research shows that when we have that strong support network, we're more confident about our future health. It really helps us really take preventative measures, engage in problem solving, and act readily on medical advice. So social support is one of the best things we can do for our health over time.
And it's not just human support. So I read an article, an excellent article you wrote about the health benefits of pets. Of course, as a dog owner, I really appreciated it. Now, can you tell us how owning a dog might make a person healthier?
Yes, and I love talking about this topic. The article I wrote was inspired by my female miniature poodle, Belle, that I got a little over a year ago, and I was so struck with the all that she was offering my life that I previously had been missing out on. So there are many benefits to owning a pet like a dog or cat. Owning a pet really opens up a whole new world of meaning, whole new world of people. It gets you outside on a regular basis, you know, walking that dog, or maybe you live in a community that has dog parks that you can go out in. People stop you and want to pet your dog or meet your dog, so it allows an entry point to communication or contact with strangers previously missed. And we find that pet owners, especially dog owners, exercise more, because they have to walk more. You know, in the winter, they got to get out and walk that dog. We also find that there's pet owners have lower cardiac disease risk. And actually, petting an animal can help lower blood pressure. A friend of mine went to a petting zoo this spring and was petting the baby goats. And I thought that was a great way to get around animals if you don't actually have one at home. And again, pets also provide some buffer against stress. Having the pet, petting the dog, as I said, will decrease stress levels in the body and will cause hormones like oxytocin to release and helps decrease those cortisol levels. And some studies show that having that pet can actually help lower blood pressure.
In your field of health psychology, what does the science show can be especially impactful in building or maintaining brain health?
Another area that we're seeing so much research being done in is mindfulness meditation. We find that in as little as 2 weeks of a daily practice of mindfulness, we're starting to see brain changes. Some of the work looks at 8 weeks of doing 20 minutes a day of mindfulness. And we find that there are changes in the prefrontal cortex and new neuronal pathways are being strengthened. One study that was done at the University of Wisconsin comparing a control group that was on the wait list to a group that went through that 8-week mindfulness course found that at the end of the 8 weeks, there was greater activation in the left prefrontal cortex. So people had more vigor, optimism, enthusiasm, buoyancy, and actually even a better response to the flu vaccine. And the right prefrontal cortex was less active in that treatment group, with people having less anger, fear, anxiety, and depression. So studies show that when we're engaging in mindfulness, it also strengthens the pathways in the brain associated with focus and attention. And as I highlighted, also better emotion regulation. So I think if that mind-body connection, we can exercise the body through exercise, but we also want to equally exercise the mind. And having a simple mindfulness meditation practice, there's so many apps out there people can use or groups available maybe in people's community to do a home practice or join a group. Again, it's kind of like taking our brain to the gym, and we can take more responsibility for the shaping of our brain through simple practices like this.
I often will use the number 20 minutes in my clinic, and I think it's probably because of some of the episodes or articles you've written and some that I found online. Can people do 20 minutes broken up? Can you do two 10-minute sessions, or really should it be a concentrated amount of time?
That's a great question. People are always wondering what's the right dosage. And I always say start where you can start. Sometimes when I say 20 minutes, that can feel really overwhelming to people, especially if they've never meditated. To start a new habit and expect people to do 20 minutes a day from the get-go is often unrealistic, and then people give up. So I say if you can do 5 minutes, start with 5 minutes, and that's a great place to start. If you can increase, wonderful. And trying to get up to the 20 minutes would be a good goal. But if you can only do it twice a day for 10 minutes, I always say that's better than nothing. And I'm a big fan of active meditation. So sometimes people think mindfulness is all about sitting in that lotus pose, eyes closed, chanting Om. But I actually utilize myself personally. I always recommend to patients that you can be very mindful while you're walking. While you're eating, you can do mindful eating. Maybe you're at a concert and you're listening to that music in that mindful way. So it doesn't have to be just in one position, sitting, closing your eyes. But I always encourage people to really engage mindfully with the world around them. And that can be formal practice too.
I'm glad you said that, because many people in clinic will say to me, well, I've never meditated. I don't think I can do that. But we all can walk and we can all think about what we're doing as we're eating. These are all practices, if we think about it in the right way, we're all capable of doing.
Absolutely. And I would say to your patients, you probably are doing mindfulness. You're just not labeling it that way, because mindfulness really is about being present in a particular way on purpose in a non-judgmental stance. Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn describes it that way. And so we can be mindful. We probably are mindful when we're seeing a sunset, or we're hanging out with a grandchild, or we're eating a really good piece of food. And so we say mindful practice, that we're just actually practicing those moments that might be naturally occurring and using something as a focal point, whether it's a sound or a smell or an image, or in a more traditional practice, it's using the breath as that focal point or anchor that you're noticing. And when your mind wanders, you just simply bring it back. And again, this is just training our brain. I think we're going to see more and more of this, taking this responsibility for the shaping of our brain. And we know we have at the University of Wisconsin, the Center for Healthy Minds, doing a lot of the neuroscience around this, and Dr. Richie Davidson, who's one of the pioneers, really showing the science around the benefits. I think it's one of the best things we can do. It's the best time we're spending in our day to shape, to really train our brain in this way so that we can be more present in our life and more of life can show up.
Now, we have a lot of listeners who are caregivers for spouses and family members who have dementia. What advice or coping strategies would you offer someone who's feeling stress and pressure as a caregiver specifically?
It is easy to start to burn out as a caregiver. Caregiver burnout is a real thing, and caring for somebody, a family member or spouse or even loved one with dementia is like a long distance journey. It's not a sprint. So I encourage people to, if you're in that caregiver role, to take some time to recharge. You have to put the oxygen mask on yourself before you can put it on somebody else. So it's really important to prioritize your own self-care. And sometimes people feel selfish or guilty, but it is essential that you stay healthy. You can't pour from an empty cup. And if you get to the point that you're depleted and burned out, you don't have anything to offer, and then it can get into a really stressful situation. So you might need to schedule a little time each week that you're doing something enjoyable, like one of your hobbies. It's important to get your own support. So you might have a trusted friend that you can turn to, or you might even want to seek the support of a professional like a counselor or a therapist. And I also encourage just getting good sleep and eating well and your own exercise, so you are refueling yourself and with those healthy things.
In closing, can you share with our listeners some of the mindfulness techniques that you employ in your own life to stay happy, healthy, and motivated?
I would love to share two different practices that have been especially meaningful for me and have really contributed to my own well-being. The first is just starting the day with some mindfulness. When you first wake up in the morning, it's easy to turn to your phone and look at your data and answer those texts or emails or search social media. But when you do that, you're in a sense getting hooked by things coming at you from your device. And that isn't the best way to start your day. Instead, start with some mindful breathing. You might even set some intentions for your day of what you want to experience or what you want to do or what you want to remember. And that brief pause can really set your day up for success. And it also really helps you connect back with yourself in a reminder of what's meaningful and important. The second practice is whenever I'm transitioning from one thing to another, like when I arrived here and started talking with you, I take an intentional pause. And there's a practice called the three P's, where you pause, presence, and proceed. So the first step is just pause, like if you're arriving home after a busy work day, or maybe you're arriving at a doctor's appointment, or you're just feeling kind of frantic and want to reground and center. The first step is to pause, just stop what you're doing, and just check in with yourself. Where are you at? What are you feeling? Where's your mind? The second P is to presence. Really bring your attention into the moment and just start to breathe a little more deeply. And that is, in a sense, just really anchoring you here and now in the present moment. And you can even ask yourself, what is this situation asking of you? And then from that place of presence, and I think personal power, you then go to the last P, which is to proceed, using mindful speech, action, positive intention, always remembering to be gentle with yourself.
Well, that's wonderful. I feel like that was therapy in the last 3 minutes. With that, you know, I'd like to thank you again for being on Dementia Matters, and we do hope to have you in the future.
I'd love to be back. Thanks again. It was a wonderful interview.
Dementia Matters is brought to you by the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. The Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center combines academic, clinical, and research expertise from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and the Geriatric Research Education and Clinical Center of the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. It receives funding from private, university, state, and national sources, including a grant from the National Institutes of Health for Alzheimer's Disease Centers. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and edited by Abishir Adin. Our musical jingle is Cases to Rest by Blue Dot Sessions. Check out our website at adrc.wisc.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. If you have any questions or comments, email us at dementiamatters@medicine.wisc.edu. Thanks for listening.